Lecture 23, Sartre on Sex and Love.
In No Exit, each character wants to impose his or her desires and self-conceptions on the others. Garcin, in particular, is torn about who he really is, a hero or a coward. But to confirm the way he would like to think of himself, he has to turn to Estelle or Inez to agree with him. He turns to Estelle, and she suggests a kind of a swap. He makes love to her and gives her the recognition she craves as a woman, and she in turn will tell him, basically, whatever he wants to hear. But as we all know, hearing what we want to hear from a person who tells us just because they know that's what we want to hear is deeply unsatisfying and often suspicious. So Estelle's deal won't work, and Garcin turns his attention to Inez. But Inez, who has no great respect for Garcin's manliness or his worries, won't give him the answer he wants, and as the play ends, we get the sense they're going to be playing cat and mouse with his identity for all of eternity. But of course, also in this play, there is an underlying, quite intentional, sexual element. The fact that Estelle needs Garcin to want her. The fact that Garcin is a very macho man who would, in fact, want her very much if he didn't have other things on his mind. Inez's own desire for Estelle. And of course, Estelle's repulsion for Inez's advances in turn. All this adds up to a literally diabolical sexual intrigue. And Sartre wants to play on that to illustrate a number of basic truths. Now notice that even if these three characters are to be in hell for all of eternity, nevertheless they are strangers when we meet them in the play, and they are just meeting each other. The extent to which we have these sorts of identity struggles between us really depends in many ways on degree of intimacy. Intimacy is very often thought of as a very desirable thing, but as you can guess, in Sartre's shift from being with others to being for others, intimacy itself is going to be a kind of a threat, a very dangerous situation. We tend to think about intimate relations in terms of their desirability, in terms of their completeness, in terms of their comfort level. What Sartre wants to suggest, perhaps perversely, but I think very profoundly, is that even such intimate relationships as love and friendship, in fact, are struggles. They are not simply being with, but they're being for, and very often in a similarly diabolical sense. First of all, we might look at love as a kind of struggle for authenticity in Heidegger's sense. In other words, we might look at love as a struggle for being one's own person. But of course, the very concept of love, in a way, undermines this. And this is something that people in love have often struggled with, of being in a lover relationship and being with one another, and yet maintaining their own sense of identity and independence. There's a sense in which we use a very ugly term today to talk about when love relationships overstep this boundary and take away mutual independence. We could talk about codependency, which is viewed as a quasi-pathological condition. But the question is whether dependency, something like codependency, isn't present in all love relationships, and consequently not just psychologically, but ontologically, is something to be avoided. When we look at Sartre, who talks about love not as a kind of benign relationship, but as a struggle, what we see is that it extends not just to love between lovers and spouses, but also it extends to all relationships. And let me work my way into love from something that is in between, a relationship between strangers and mere acquaintances, and something which is a full-blown intimate love affair or marriage. And that's friendship. I often remark to my students that their friends are rarely such a matter of circumstance as they often suggest, namely, this is a roommate that I happen to be put in with when my freshman year, or this is someone I happen to go to high school with. Because, of course, there are many colleagues in high school, and only some of them turn out to be friends. And even if you are assigned to a roommate, you still have a number of basic choices. For example, whether to like or despise that person, whether to hang out or avoid them completely. People choose their friends, and it's very interesting to ask on what grounds they choose them. And I think the answer comes through fairly quickly. We choose our friends on the basis of, among other things, our conception of ourselves. That's not to say that friendship is narcissistic. It doesn't follow that we choose people like ourselves. In fact, we might choose people very different than ourselves. For example, if I'm not very intelligent and I'm concerned about my lack of intelligence, I might take up with an extremely intelligent woman precisely in order to have her intelligence in some sense radiate onto me. Or if I'm not very physically adept, I might well go out with an athlete and make friends with athletes as a way of being part of a crowd which is athletic. Very often, we pick people who are contrasts, who are opposites, rather than just like us as friends. But the idea is that in friendship, what we do is we pick people who are going to reinforce, in some sense, our own conception of ourselves. So if I think of myself as intelligent, or I want to think of myself as intelligent, whether or not I pick a partner who is also intelligent, what is going to be essential is that it's going to be a partner who somehow expands my notion of my own intelligence, either by telling me all the time, perhaps, how intelligent I am, or maybe by always contradicting me in such a way that I can prove my intelligence with her or him. In other words, friendship is not just falling in with people whom you happen to like. That's a very superficial characterization. Friendship is a kind of agreement, a kind of contract in American terms. The idea is basically, I will approve of you in your terms if you will approve of me in my terms. And consequently, we form a kind of partnership in which the shared aim is to mutually improve each of our self-conceptions. Now, the thing about friends is that most of us have many friends. One can make a kind of exception here. There is something which in the 19th century was referred to as romantic friendship. And of course, among the Greeks, there were stories about friends, primarily male friends, who were just as exclusive and intimate as any pair of lovers. But for the most part, we certainly talk about friendship in a very general way. In fact, I would say a promiscuous way. We often refer to someone as a friend, meaning we've had dinner with them once or talked to them once. But if you think about what it means to be a friend, what you understand is that friendship involves a kind of mutual identity. First of all, the mutual identity as friends, but also the sense in which we identify ourselves through our friends. But the fact that we have many friends, or at least several friends, means that there's a sense in which this identity is diffuse, and we don't depend all that strongly on any one friend for how we think of ourselves. On the other hand, when we're talking about lovers, the picture becomes very different. Whether or not this is a universal necessity, it is surely clear that in the Western tradition, love is conceived of as a more or less exclusive relationship. Of course, there are people who have many lovers. Sartre was one of them. And by distributing one's identity among many lovers, one weakens the power of being for others with any one of them. But by the same token, because that's true, lovers tend to be very defensive exclusivity, and in comes a kind of double standard. We want to expand our own sense of options and identity by dealing with many lovers, but at the same time, we want to be, for each of them, their only one. And the reason for that is because with this kind of intimacy and exclusiveness, we get a kind of control. Well, control of what? We tend to think of love, as I said, in a rather benign way. Sartre introduces love as a seductive strategy. When we fall in love, and love, of course, can succeed or fail, and with it, we can succeed or fail, what we are concerned with is how we can win over the other. For example, how we can get the other to think of us as we like to think of ourselves. And of course, again, there's a kind of bargain, a kind of contract. The other thinks the same of us. Remember back when you went on your first date, or in any given relationship, the first date. What is it like? Well, let's leave aside all the anxiety and the rest of it, and just to talk about the kind of social dynamics. First, you dress and talk in such a way as to present yourself not only in the best light possible, but the best light as you conceive of it in terms of the kind of person you want to be. And we all remember back in our teenage years when we weren't sure what kind of a person that was, or the kind of person was actually quite at odds with the person we were prone to be. But nevertheless, we presented ourselves in a certain way in order to get the person we were out with to think of us that way. The other person, of course, was doing the same thing. As the conversation proceeds, probably on fairly safe grounds to begin with, where do you go to school or what do you study? There's a sense in which we're kind of feeling our way and trying to find new openings, new ways of presenting ourselves which appeal to the other person. To talk about seduction here might sound a bit sinister, but there's a sense in which to think of it as a seduction is really just to say it's not direct, that what you do is simply present to the other person all the evidence and considerations that he or she needs in order to think of you in the way that you like. It's seductive not in that it's secretive, much less that it's sinister, but rather it's trying to win the other person over in a very basic sense. But as I said, love can fail. And when you think about failed love, it doesn't just result in the end of a relationship, but rather it turns into something else. And Sartre discusses many different possibilities. If what we're trying to do when we are in love with another person, when we are in a relationship with another person, is win them over to our way of thinking, to take control of them, then one natural result of a failed love is to take that attempt to control and simply make it explicit. And what we get is sadism. Sadism here doesn't necessarily refer to cruelty, and it doesn't necessarily refer to any kind of physical abuse. But sadism, as Freud also argued, is really a kind of latent tendency in all relationships. Because insofar as love is an attempt to gain control, sadism is a kind of desperate, explicit attempt to take that control. But I'm talking really about love just in one of its dimensions. That's the dimension in which we talk about love in terms of dominating the other person or manipulating the other person's view of you in a kind of straightforward way. But of course, we don't always do that. Sometimes in a love relationship, we take a much more submissive position. And in fact, one might even say that love is essentially not so much the dominating position as so much as the submissive one. But here what we run across is a very different kind of tendency, because when we take a submissive position, it's not as if we are saying to the other person, make of me what you will, but quite to the contrary. We're putting the other person in a position where he or she must please me. When this fails, again, it becomes explicit. And what we find is masochism, which again should not be confused with cruelty or physical abuse, but rather it is a manipulative attitude towards the other which replaces the much more subtle mechanism which love tries to bring about. We might also talk here about indifference, and here we mean not just not caring, but the kind of profound and very annoying indifference that one finds, for example, in an ex-lover, someone who just now won't pay attention to you, won't acknowledge you even as another human being. And that, of course, can lead to hatred, which is a more extreme form of the same kind of hostile attitude. In short, what we find is that love, contrary to the kind of ethereal way that we think of it, is a kind of dynamic in which a kind of mutual manipulation is essential. Now, all of this is talking in a rather abstract sense about love. When we talk about intimacy, what we often have in mind, in fact, some people would even define it this way, is a sexual relationship. And as we saw in No Exit, there's a kind of sexual subtext which is in many ways definitive of the relationship between the characters. It is not just a matter of happenstance that one of them is a macho male, one is a coquette, and one is a lesbian. But rather, it's this kind of sexual dynamic which really makes the play move. What are the dynamics of sex? What is sexual desire? We've all been taught in this society that it's something wrong to turn a person into a sex object. Feminists for the last 40 years have complained bitterly about magazines and the male gaze for doing this. But there's a sense in which sexuality is essentially reducing the other to an object. Sartre points out that when you make love to a person and the parts of a person which become most attractive in sex are precisely those parts of a person which are, in a way, the least human, the most fleshy, the least dynamic, breasts, buttocks, thighs, and so on. Now, what Sartre's pointing out here is something that, on the one hand, is a bit perverse, but at the same time, I think it's something worth dwelling on. When we love someone for their personality, their intelligence, their charm, why is it that sex itself tends to treat them in a way which really doesn't leave much room for all of those traits, except in perhaps the very unusual relationship? Why does sex, in fact, so focus on something which is, in one way of thinking, a very basic animal activity? And of course, there are all kinds of pseudo-biological explanations of this, some of which, of course, have a lot of truth behind them. But Sartre wants to say, it's all besides the point. I mean, there are many biological acts that we perform, eating, for instance, but of course, we dress it up in an enormous variety of ways, depending on our culture and depending on what the ethics and customs of the culture happen to be. How about with sex? We often talk about sex as cutting underneath culture and a return straight to our animal nature. But Sartre thinks quite the opposite. That it's what is part of what is most human about us. It's often been commented that people have sex in a way that virtually no animal has sex. And this is not true just by virtue of the biology and the difference between the way we have courtship rituals and so on. But it's a more basic sense. And, of course, what it comes down to is the fact that we, in having sex, are conscious, and we are self-conscious, and we are conscious of the other. We are conscious of the other's consciousness of us. And so sex, like love, turns out to be a kind of strategy, a kind of manipulative strategy in which what we try to do is win over the other to our own self-conceptions. But what does this have to do with reducing the other to an object? Well, here we enter another of those very tricky dialectics that Sartre likes to talk about. Because on the one hand, what we want to do is we want to put the other in a position, possibly by giving him or her so much pleasure that he or she will tell us whatever it is we want to hear, like Estelle in No Exit. But at the same time, if we succeed, on the one hand, we have just produced somebody who will simply tell us whatever we want to hear, and they are not therefore trustworthy. Or, on the other, we might give them so much pleasure that they won't tell us or see us as anything at all. They will stop making judgments altogether. That, of course, is one of the possible aims of sexual activity, in a way, to simply shut the other person up. But, of course, again, this is only half the picture. Because what we also see in sex is a kind of submissiveness, but not a kind of submissiveness which is simply, do what you like, I'm just here for you. But it too is, or can be, very manipulative. It is a way of getting the other person to exercise all of his or her efforts towards pleasing you, and in that way controlling what they are thinking, and in particular, what they are thinking of you. By reducing the other to a vehicle of pleasure, what you do is you manipulate. But this is to say that pleasure is not the aim of sex, but rather pleasure is a kind of vehicle which you use to control the other person. If you take too much pleasure in it yourself, the pleasure gets in the way. And what you do, in fact, is you eliminate sex as the vehicle for just the power that you are trying to attain. Because make no mistake for Sartre, sex is about power. It's a very Nietzschean view. And the aim is to see our relationships not as a simple being with others, but rather as a kind of power play. And romance is a kind of play of wills. Now, what I've been saying sounds very perverse, and in fact, it sounds very perverse to me, too. But nevertheless, I think what Sartre's doing is something incredibly important. What he's doing is he's taking something which has been buried in so much nonsense over the last 2,000 years, and giving us a very realistic, a brutally realistic view of the kind of psychodynamics, or he would say ontological dynamics, that are really at stake. It goes back to an earlier philosophical picture given to us by Hegel, which I've anticipated several times, and it has to do with his dialectic between master and slave, or between domination and submission. In Hegel's story, two people essentially fight it out until one becomes master of the other, and the loser becomes the slave. Unfortunately, it's not a stable relationship, and through various attempts to either alter the relationship or escape from it, both parties leave essentially quite unhappy. The same kind of vision is what Sartre wants to give us in his view of sex and love. We think of it as a kind of benign coupling, something that brings great satisfaction to everyone. And what Sartre wants to point out is that sex and love, in fact, are much more complicated and much more threatening and dangerous than we usually like to admit. Perhaps he would say that there's no satisfaction to be gained from them. I think, in fact, that's an oversimplification. But nevertheless, I think what he does is he opens our eyes to complexities that have been buried under an avalanche of nonsense over the last 2,000 years. Philosophers, especially, have talked about love in very ethereal, even heavenly ways. And the metaphors that we think of when we think about love are such that they really distract us from any kind of critical attention. I know, watching young people, they almost always say something like, on the one hand, love is wonderful, beautiful, the thing I really want to live for. And at the same time, they complain about their own love relationships and say that in a profound sense which they don't understand, they're unsatisfying or they're threatening in a way which they can't handle. Well, it seems to me to understand what Sartre's trying to combat, one should look at some of these traditional myths and glosses. And let me pick one, which in fact is one of my favorites. It's a piece of Plato's Symposium, and it's a tale told by the playwright Aristophanes, and it's supposed to characterize the true nature of love. What Aristophanes tells us is that love is the product of an ancient history in which what we call human beings were much different creatures than they are today. We were, in fact, double creatures with two sets of arms, two sets of legs, two heads. And we were so intelligent, consequently, that we offended the gods. And Zeus essentially threatened to split us in two. And he did. Ever since, Aristophanes says, we've been running around the world trying to find our other half. What love is, what sex is a kind of completion. The idea of completing ourselves through the other, on the one hand, jives rather nicely with Sartre's conception of being for others. That is, we are not, in a sense, independent of other people. Being for others is an essential part of our own being. But the idea of completing ourselves in the sense that Aristophanes suggests, making ourselves complete with another person with whom we perfectly fit, is quite at odds with Sartre's rather perverse view of love and sex. First, to say the obvious, there is no such perfect fit. The people we meet, the people we fall in love with, are quite different from ourselves. The analogy that Aristophanes uses in his little story is cut in half like an apple. But if you take the two halves of an apple and press them together, of course they fit quite perfectly. On the other hand, if you take two halves of different apples, which have been split rather crudely, what you find is it takes a good deal of grinding to get them to fit together. And the truth is, the people that we meet have been brought up differently, perhaps even in different cultures, different religions, different ways of thinking, different sets of habits. And any relationship, as we all know, doesn't just fit together, even in the sort of vernacular of we were made for each other. But we have to develop a relationship over a period of time in which there's a good deal of adjustment and compromise, which goes into fitting together so nicely. But of course, Sartre means something deeper than this. It's not just a question of the amount of time and energy that it takes to fit, but rather, there is no such fit, because even in the best relationship, what we find is that there's a kind of struggle going on. And while we might, at the beginning of a relationship, distract ourselves from this with sexual excitement, people often make an awful relationship, but don't see it for sometimes even years because they manage to so distract themselves. Or, later on in a relationship, we might find all different mechanisms of distraction and denial, getting lost in our careers, or friends on the side, or not paying attention to the relationship, just sitting and watching television. But if you pay any attention to your relationship, and especially in times of crisis and trouble. What becomes very clear is that there is a kind of struggle going on, even though there's an adjustment and accommodation that can take place over the years that makes it seem less and less like an actual struggle. And again, the picture is going to be the same, that we are trying to maintain our own conception of ourselves in the face of the judgments of the other person. Now, I would say, in correction to Sartre here, that what he doesn't take seriously enough is the fact that very often our conceptions of ourselves are not only in the face of the other, but there's a kind of cooperation that can take place on the level of actually trying to think of ourselves in mutual terms, something which Sartre alludes to, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But the idea that the way we think of ourselves is something which is always at risk because of the other person is, of course, true. You can think without much trouble, but with a great deal of pain, of the person with whom you have spent much of your life turning to you suddenly one day and issuing the kind of criticism that never allows us to think of ourselves the same again. Or we can imagine ourselves in a fit of rage or whatever, saying the sort of thing that not just hurt feelings, but destroys relationships, precisely because we see that we have found the fault or the fault line in the other person's way of thinking about themselves, and we have driven a wedge in it. The point, again, is that relationships, however stable they may seem, are never truly stable, just as in our conceptions of ourselves, we are never fully at peace with ourselves. There's a word that Sartre here borrows from chemistry. It's the word metastability. And it refers to a situation which, at a given moment, appears to be perfectly in balance. But nevertheless, a slight disruption causes the whole system to fall into disarray. The example I like here is the idea of a waiter carrying, say, 5 or 6 cups of hot coffee. And if he balances them well, he can probably get to the table with no trouble at all. On the other hand, if there's some slight mishap, a small trip, perhaps a little curl in the rug, or if just one drop of hot coffee hits his skin, then of course he'll flinch, he'll react, and that's the end of it. Suddenly all 6 cups of coffee go flying into the air and we've got a catastrophe on our hands. So too, our conceptions of ourselves at any given moment might seem to be stabilized and fairly fixed. We know who we are in our career, we know who we are in our friendships, and in a relationship, we might feel perfectly comfortable that we have now accommodated ourselves, adjusted ourselves to a life together. But it's metastable in the sense that one hot drop of coffee might nevertheless throw the whole thing into catastrophe. Once again, I don't want to endorse Sartre's picture so much as I think it's very important to present it, and to present it in all its brutal completeness. Because what he does, again, is he opens our eyes to the complexities of our relationships in a way that Aristophanes, for example, seems to deny. Yet two things should modify this view. First of all, Sartre himself had a lifelong relationship with Simone de Beauvoir. And despite many infidelities on his part, a few on hers, and a good deal of things that I think most of us would think are at best eccentric in a relationship, such as the refusal to get married over all that time, nevertheless, they really occupy a place as one of the premier couples, certainly the premier philosophical couple, in the 20th century. One might contrast it with Bertrand Russell, who, despite all of his words of praise for love, nevertheless managed to go through quite a few marriages and, by his own admission, found none of them satisfactory. So the Beauvoir relationship is one that I would hold up as a kind of counterexample to Sartre's own philosophy. Granted, it has filled with tensions and complexities, but nevertheless, Sartre showed that he was capable of, in some sense, the real thing. And the second thing to say is that Sartre did, in fact, find a mode of being with others as opposed to being for others. But I guess as we can predict from his plays and his writings, it wasn't to be in the realm of romance. Rather, it was in the realm of politics. And what Sartre claimed was that true being with others was something that one found in the mutuality of being under threat on the battlefield, or more to the point, behind the barricades of a Parisian revolution. So Sartre does want to say that there is such a thing as being with others, but it's only in fairly extreme circumstances. And once again, we go back to that question about human nature. Where do we find its measure? Well, not in ordinary bourgeois life, which Sartre despised, but rather in the extremities of politics and political crises.